I hereby introduce to you Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, 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 welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. Ladles and jelly spoons, he says, shamelessly nicking from Tim Ferriss of the 4-Hour Workweek. I am back with a wonderful guest today, and that is Penny Lowe of Wellington Consulting. And the reason that's wonderful is that it's really, really, really time we had an accountant on the show, and Penny is that person. So many of my Amazon selling friends have huge problems with their accounting and bookkeeping. It's the biggest pain point I can think of. I had to pick one single item. For most entrepreneurs, that's it. So Penny, you're very, very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. And hello to everybody listening.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming on. And been a while working on getting you on the show. I've been twisting Penny's arm for a while and persuaded her on. So I'm delighted because there are so many important questions around this stuff. So right from the off, let's kick off with the question that comes up quite a lot for people who are starting off with their Amazon businesses or just about to start one, is the question of a sole trader versus limited company. What are your thoughts on that?
As with a lot of things, there's an advantage to following each. One of the big things to sort out is your trading name, because if you do decide to go as a limited company, it's important that name is available, and you could also then use it as your sole trader, so you're not confusing people by changing halfway through. As a sole trader, there's all sorts of expenses that you can set off and have a portion of those expenses to set off against tax and reduce your tax bill at the end of the day. As far as a limited company goes, the rules are much, much stricter, both in the way that you keep your books, but also in what you can actually have as allowable expenses as far as the tax man's concerned. So it's a bit of swings and roundabouts, and really it depends on almost each expense which it's best to have. From an ease point of view, and the first few months of getting going, you may well choose to start as a sole trader. The benefit of that is that the first 3 months, you don't have to register as that sole trader. So if you give it a go for a couple of months and go, yeah, this isn't for me, you haven't got all sorts of things to unpick over a period of time. However, at the end of the second month, you should be getting a feel as to whether it's going to suit you. And that's when you can start thinking, register as a sole trader, or alternatively, go straight into setting up a limited company. Limited companies aren't easy to unpick. So it is worth putting some thought into it and asking somebody before you go too far down the road.
Okay, well, that sounds like excellent advice. And just to sort of feedback, what am I understanding? That really the idea that you try it out for 2 months and then, coming up to month three, you make a decision. That sounds very good to me, because I think that the more I try and help other people build businesses, the more experience I get. It's a very iterative process. In other words, you've got to try things out. And if it works, you scale it up. And if it doesn't, you kill it off. So even applying to the whole business as a whole, that's true. So that's a very, very wise thought, actually. The one caveat I'd throw in there, which isn't strictly an accounting thing, but it's an Amazon thing, is this, that for anyone listening who's wanting to do this, if you want to change over your Amazon Seller Central account in the UK from being owned by a sole trader or usable by a sole trader to a company, you often can't do that. So just a little caveat, little heads up, which isn't strictly speaking a bookkeeping or accounting thing, but other than that, that makes a lot of sense. So
I was just going to say, that's also true with a bank account. If you set a bank account up as a sole trader to run and use with your business, if you then become limited, you would have to set up a second or different bank account for that limited company.
Okay. Yes, which is worth bearing in mind. It's a little bit of logistics, whereas with the Amazon account, that kind of kills off the possibility of scaling that business. You effectively have to start a new one. So, which is not true if you, for example, want to try the business model out in the UK with a bit of retail arbitrage and then scale up in America. You could play around as a sole trader for 2, 3, 5 months in the UK, and then you can set up a company and trade in America, for example. But so tell us a bit more about the differences. So obviously, is it really a complicated thing setting up a limited company? And I'm plunging into this because it's one of the first questions people often come across. And from the business building sort of logical A, B, C, D, E, F, G process, one, you know, in order, it's something I think that needs to be dealt with fairly early on. Is it really a complex thing, and what are the complications there?
Right. To set up a limited company is actually very easy. You can potentially do it yourself, or there's all sorts of companies online that will set it up for you. when setting up a limited company, one of the things you need to decide is where you're going to have your registered office. The registered office can be your home. It can be a family member's home. It can be changed in future. So if you're in rented accommodation, that's not too much of an issue, but you'd have to update any websites, etc., that quoted your registered office. Just make sure that there's no restriction on your rental agreement that you can't have a business running from that address. So once you've decided on where you're going to have as your registered office, then you can set up your limited company in quite a straightforward way. You can't if you're bankrupt, and there are restrictions like that on being a director, and it gets complicated if you start having a nominee director and trying to trade through somebody else. But actually setting it up, one of the first things to do is decide on a name. When you're looking at the name, what I do for people is search the web and see what other names or similar names there are, because Companies House would not let you set a company up with a similar name. Having said that, you can sometimes get away with a very close name, but with my company name, for example, Wellington Consulting, I was doing a check for somebody else the other day on a name they were looking at doing, and when I checked, somebody has set up Wellington Consulting Group Limited, and they've got the same type of business as myself. So what I've done, complained to Companies House, and I'm just waiting for confirmation, because typically that company would then get a letter telling them they've got to change their name. So although you might sneak it into Companies House, you might find the business that has got a similar name may object and cause you to have to change your name. Changing a name, again, isn't a big problem, except from all your marketing literature, etc. You would have to do further work with that.
Absolutely. One thing I would say is I did this the other day for my company, actually, well, one of my companies. And the reason I did it is because people often assume that a business name is the same as the brand name you sell under, which is the same as the limited company. In other words, they just think of a business has one name. But of course, everything can be more nuanced than that. And I would strongly advise any Amazon sellers, my pro tip for that is actually to not have the same company name as the name you sell on Amazon. Now, why would that be? It's not because we're trying to fool any consumers. It's simply because the only people that will be interested in that are other people trying to reverse engineer your business and steal your best product ideas. So I personally think you're better off actually having a separate issue around the name. So obviously the same check that you just went through, Penny, would apply, but that's a sort of legal and companies issue, not a marketing thing. And actually also, if you do that, then you've separated out the issues of what you put in your marketing and so forth. So those are my thoughts. Is that going to work okay? Is there anything from your point of view that would create a problem?
No, not a problem. What I would say is, as far as the banks go, if you are going to trade under a different name, it's worth letting them know. So if your business account, for example, is Wellington Consulting, but you want to also accept checks in the name of Penny Lowe for business purposes, let them know when you set the account up. And that way they have a checklist of other things that checks can be written to or payments made to. Because again, people are paying you directly.
Yeah.
That information will need to be handed out to them.
That's a very good point, actually. I must remember that I've got to update things with Payoneer, although the idea of people writing you checks in the Amazon world is kind of entertaining. I mean, I've never been paid by check for anything I've ever sold online, but you're right, the other systems need to make sense with it. So I think that's a good nuance. As ever, it's a lot of the details is what a good accountant will catch, folks, which is already, Penny's reminding me of some things in my own business here. I was just about to plunge into another load of detailed questions, and the devil is in the detail, and often accountants are the people who are good at details, as I've just said. But let's just take a bigger picture question, which is really, what do you think are the biggest mistakes that people make when they're just setting up a new business, if possible, that if you've seen it on Amazon? I guess maybe I made some of those and you can use me as an example. Also, what are the classic mirrors just generally made by online sellers or even just new business people in general?
I think one of the biggest things is underestimating the costs. That when you buy something and sell it on, in simple terms, you think, oh, the only cost is the actual purchase of that item. But whatever you're selling, if it's something physical, then you've got the delivery costs. So that's one element. You've got commission, you've got what might be PayPal or fees like that. that all eat into the difference between how much you buy things for and how much you sell them for. An example of this, or another example, is samples and replacements. If you shipped an item that either hasn't got there or is faulty when it arrives, you've got to ship the next one free of charge, typically, and you've got a second lot of shipping on that one. So it's some of these costs which really, you know, sneak in, and unless you sit down or have done it before, you know, you can just find that you're actually selling things at a loss, and that's not what you're in business to do.
Absolutely. And I can agree with that. Replacement costs actually can add up on Amazon, even if your defect rate is relatively low. I mean, if you're selling something, for example, that you normally sell for $15, but if you have to send it, so this is in the US-based example, obviously, if I'm selling something for about $15 and it's around about a $5 profit in that normally, but if I have, I don't know, one in 50 that I might have to replace if it's not a particularly great batch, then each time I replace it, I've got the cost of goods sold there, which cost me about $5 landed cost. And then I've got to do expedited shipping to keep people happy. In other words, it gets there quickly. So that's about another $8. So I lose about $13 per one of those. So I suppose for every 50 units, I'd have to divide those $13 across that to take account for that. Is that how you would do it? Or how do I sort of measure that in proper accounting terms?
Yes, that's the easiest way, remembering that things like samples or any faulty goods that can't be shipped, you know, damaged in transit and things like that, would also need to be included in the calculation of what your extra costs are for items that you have purchased that you don't get the full money for.
Makes perfect sense, yeah. And I guess... yeah, I guess things like samples, actually, you're right, is something that's quite easy to overlook. Now, how would you, for example, if I ordered, when I was selling music stand lights a while ago, I've sold those for quite a long time, so I tend to use those as my go-to example because I don't really care if somebody else gets the idea of selling them because I'm kind of moving out of that space now. But let's say I ordered 5 different samples of that stuff from China, which is roughly what I did, and the cost was around $50 each, so I spent $250 in samples. Let's take 2 scenarios. Let's say scenario A is where I go, okay, I'm now going to go forward and sell one of those. How do I ascribe that cost? Do I put that as a sort of direct cost relative to that product? Or do I just say that's part of overheads? Or do I sort of do an in-betweeny thing?
If it's samples before you decide to go to that line, it's almost a research and development cost and therefore wouldn't be attributed to that particular item itself. This is where we start to look at the difference between management accounts, where you know, you're interested that if you get, say, samples from 10 different suppliers to see which one you want to go with, you may well decide to attribute that cost to the final item that you choose. And depending on how long you're going to sell it for, if it's, for example, a year, you might split that initial inverted commas startup cost over the year. It would be much the same if you were looking to manufacture something yourself and had to buy a kit to get the manufacturer process underway. You know, you've got to decide that if you weren't buying the kit, sorry, if you weren't producing the stuff, you wouldn't need the kit to build it in the first place. So it is directly linked. But, you know, what period of time do you expect to sell the item over? Is it just a, you know, Christmas trinket, in which case it's a short period? Or is it a substantial product that you're looking to retail for the next 2 years?
So how would you, what's the difference, say, if we get the Christmas trinket versus the one that you're going to retail for a couple of years, what's the difference in how you deal with those sample costs?
If your sample costs for the trinket amounted to $100, you would have to say, and I expect to sell 500 of these items over the Christmas period, you would then divide that cost by the 500 you were going to sell. And basically it would increase your unit price by the share of those samples. If, however, it's something you're going to be producing for 2 years, or sorry, selling for 2 years, it's then a case of however much your samples are split over 2 years and how many you intend selling over that period to work out what sort of recovery rate you'd have on the cost that you shelled out.
That's a good point, actually. So I suppose what you're doing is you're sort of bundling into the unit product cost, so the cost per unit of any new product line or an old one, I suppose. all of the costs associated with getting that thing to market, including samples and anything that isn't necessarily on the surface of it immediately collected. Is that the right way of doing it?
Yes, I think that's a justifiable way. And where we're talking about particularly startup businesses, where you want to get on with it, you're paying a lot of money for individual samples from different suppliers until you work out exactly what you want to do. There's actually an awful lot of costs involved that people don't foresee.
Okay, so what about then if I have research and development, wing of my business, which is me and my laptop, I guess, to start with, and I order 5 different samples of one particular product line. Let's say it's a music stand light. And then I order 3 different music stands and I order 5 different, what else would have I explored in the past in the music realm? 5 different guitar capos, so the things that go on guitars. And I only go ahead with the music stand lights, but the music stands I decide I can't make a profit on them. They're too expensive to ship, and I can't make a profit on the capos because they're just too cheap and there's too much competition. So how would I deal with those costs in that scenario?
Because you've got no sales to relate them to, you'd have this line in your accounts called research and development. So you'd have to write it off. But what you need to do is to make sure you, with the things you do continue, you've got enough profit in there to carry that sort of cost. In the same way as you've got a cost of an accountant, you can't necessarily attribute that to any particular sales line, but you need to make sure that you've got enough profit in your sales with the costs attributable to that item to make sure you can cover your accountancy fees.
Well, yeah, that does make sense. Yeah. So this really brings us, Penny, to that fabled question of the difference between overheads and direct costs. And, well, it's fabled in accounting circles. At least I think it's fabled. Maybe nobody else talks about it, but I think quite a lot of my entrepreneur friends do. What is the difference and why does it matter?
In simple terms, a direct cost you would not incur if you didn't sell the product. Overheads you've got to pay for anyway. So even if you set up a company and don't use it at all for the year, it's just sitting there in name only, you still need to pay Companies House £13 a year to keep it on the books. And if you can't, pay an accountant to produce some dormant accounts for you. So you haven't made any sales in the year, but there are still costs involved. Scaling that up slightly, other overheads are things like the telephone. You use that, you can't attribute it to particular sales. So if you made no sales in the year, you'd still have a telephone where you've been trying to make sales. And so it carries on from that point of view, where you've got products. If you bought them, you wouldn't have bought them if you weren't going to sell them. So therefore, they come into the direct costs area, whereas other things like your electricity bill, your website, you'd have that anyway, even if you don't get around to using it. So those are the sorts of things that one counts as overheads.
And presumably that would also include things like Jungle Scout web app, which is a software that helps you do research. It would include things like a subscription to JumpSend, which is a product launch thing. Even if you're not doing any research or launching any products at the moment, would that be also an overhead?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Great. Well, that's a very good distinction. So we've got the clear distinction, I think so anyway, unless there's anything else you want to say about that. But otherwise, my question is, why does that matter? Why do we need to split those out anyway? What's the purpose of doing that?
Right. The purpose is where you're looking at the profits of a business, you've really got two levels. One is the profit from sales, which is your sales take away the costs, your direct costs. So the things that you've incurred because you've been selling. And that will give you what's called a gross profit. And then out of that are all the overheads, the things you've got to pay for regardless, to give you a profit, hopefully, at the end of the day, for which the taxman can tax you on. So by having that distinction, it's making sure that your sales, less your cost of sales, your direct costs, leaves you enough to cover all those other items which you can't control by volume of sales.
Okay. Now let's talk, you've been mentioning tax. So let's talk about, just to sort of backtrack a bit about this stuff. What is the purpose of doing this? What's the purpose of measuring and bookkeeping and accounting? And does that have an impact on how we do it?
Yes, the benefit of keeping the books is you know whether you're making a profit or not. So if you're looking at how big a profit, it's important that you do include the various overheads, because a lot of people will say, you know, buy it for $5, sell it for $10, yippee, $5 profit. As we've discussed, there are all sorts of other costs in there that will wheedle down that gap. And whatever's left in that gap, you still need to have to cover the overheads of the business. With a lot of businesses, they're very good at issuing sales invoices, not so good at recording their cost of sales, and most particularly their expenses. And it can be quite frightening when you sit down, go through the bank statements in simple terms, just to see how much they've paid in bank charges in the year, particularly if they haven't been keeping an eye on that, and they're getting £35 a time for return direct debits. And it can be frightening, the size of the bill. So making sure that you've got money in the bank so that you don't get a spoilt reputation and extra costs by way of interest and bank charges. Also, if you are in business, one of the things you have to do, as you mentioned, is pay tax, and that's on the profits. So you need to be able to produce the paperwork, it can be electronic format nowadays, to support how those costs have been incurred and your sales, so that the taxman makes sure you're not going down the Sunday market and selling a whole load of stuff off there and pocketing the sales.
Okay.
So that's quite good reasons for keeping on top of the books.
All right. So those are very, very good reasons. So I guess the traditional split would be, so knowing whether you're making a profit, and especially tracking expenses, and you're quite right, they can add up. Overheads can really be the thing you keep less of an eye on, in my experience as an entrepreneur, because, you know, you want to know whether you're making sales, you're quite right. You're a bit more careful with the cost of goods sold, and then, yeah, overheads can run amok if you're not careful. So you're right there. From my personal experience, I'm guilty of that, as you know, as my accountant. And so I guess the difference there, Penny, is that we're looking to manage stuff, or the management accounting versus tax accounting. So one question that always comes up is, do you need one sort of grand unified system to do both management accounting and tax accounting, or do you need very different things in those arenas? What are the differences?
I think it's fair to say that if you're not careful, the monitoring of sales and those costs can become very unwieldy if you try and do it very accurately. Again, I've had clients in the past, not necessarily the Amazon area, but where somebody took on a pub and was looking at wanting to know which meals were more profitable, whether to serve something with rice or chips. And when I said to him, well, you're going to have to monitor your portion size and get down to that level of detail, he decided a slightly broader brush approach was going to be more appropriate. So it depends how many items you're selling as to how easy it is to monitor those. But to try and use a lot of the accounts software to do it can be very fiddly, because if you've got one shipment from China, which has got three different products in it, but only one shipping fee, you have to start looking very detailed as to how you're going to attribute that cost across the three products. You can use a best guess, which is always a good starting point. But if you're getting down to that level, you need to have an understanding. And from the accounting point of view, don't really care, providing we know what the costs are, what the income is. As an entrepreneur looking at your different product ranges, and you can't afford a whole accounts team to do all that detail for you, sometimes it's best to use spreadsheets, etc., to look at your detail by product, as opposed to some accounting software to actually monitor the costs and income.
Okay. So there's a few questions that come out of that. I mean, one is, well, first of all, thank you for saying a best guess is okay. Because funnily enough, I think, you know, you're an accountant with a lot of common sense, which is the kind, by the way, that I would insist everybody gets. There are some accountants out there who say, send me a load of paper receipts for things every month. And as soon as somebody says that, I say, get another accountant, because that is not common sense. So this is great to hear that a best guess is a good starting point. I can also attest, as you know, Penny, because you helped me try and create this monster, that using accounting software to try and control everything at micro level is not the best way, because we tried that. So yeah, I would agree with you from experience that sometimes a best guess can be good enough to start with. If you're doing it at scale, you're going to have to get into the weeds of it. So a couple of questions. First of all, let's answer the tech question. Everybody always wants to know the magic tool question. So is it better to use a book where you write in with a pen? It seems so incredibly old-fashioned, but it could be done. Or a spreadsheet or accounting software to measure your accounts? I'm going to put the question as crudely as that, but I think it's going to be it depends answer, I suspect.
I quite like accounts software. The reason being that it is designed for the purpose. So often I've had clients who have used spreadsheets and what we call an extended spreadsheet. So the first column might be the payment, and the columns going across the page are the different types of payments. But it's very easy to forget to extend one of those rows so that you've got it once in the payments and once in the telephone column, for example. And then going forwards, it's, you know, how do you rule it off at the end of a year? Are you interested in going forwards and being able to look at it? Good account software. You put the figure in once and it allocates it to wherever it needs to go and asks you whether you've taken it out of your bank or out of your pocket to pay for it. And it's those sorts of things that if it's easy to use, you can use regularly. If it is cumbersome, I mean, I have some clients who at the end of the year suddenly put together a spreadsheet for me and it's got so many holes in it because they're not keeping on top of it from a day-to-day basis. And where you've got systems now, for example, like QuickBooks, you can actually take a picture of the receipt on your telephone and it sends it through the cloud and straight into your account software. So it's easy to keep on top of it. And that's really what I would recommend. Pencil and paper, if you can't stand computers, I wonder whether Amazon selling is probably the best solution for you. But you could try selling pencils and pencil sharpeners on Amazon, I suppose. But I would rather see a computer used than pencil and paper. And going forwards, it's getting to the stage now that if you get to the turnover of 85,000 or above, you're going to need to register for VAT. And the VAT man is changing its rules into something called Making Tax Digital, where they need to be able to follow every entry you've made through to the reports that you need to send them, going to be on a quarterly basis. That's coming into effect for VAT registered businesses from April next year. If you're not VAT registered, it may well be the year after. So moving in that direction. So start as you mean to go on. Ideally some account software and use that, get used to it. As your business grows, you won't have to start changing systems.
Great. Oh, there's lots and lots of wisdom in there. So first of all, we're making ourselves compliant with where the tax man's going, and that's out of our control anyway, so we have to go there. And then secondly, as you just pointed out, the cost of changing systems, funnily enough, I was speaking to my business partner, Rob, who I'm getting on the podcast to talk about other things, but he's got a very strong computer programming and web programming background. And he was saying, for example, with web systems, because I'm developing an Amazon course for new sellers, which I'm very excited about. But he said, well, we're talking about various different possibilities. And again, he said about transitioning from one system to another. You know, if you don't have to, it's always a nightmare. There's always mistakes made. You might as well set it up as you mean to go on if it's going to work. So that's very wise advice. And that's exactly the same advice you're giving here. So that's very reassuring. So QuickBooks, you've mentioned, I know that Xero works for a lot of people as well. Any other thoughts around using a software system? Because as soon as people get software working, and I do this, as you know, it can become quite complex quite fast. What's your sort of way of getting through this? If somebody's starting out new, but they've had just enough turnover to go, okay, there's a potential business here, and they're setting up QuickBooks or Xero for that matter, what's your simplest advice? What's the sort of minimum necessary force that we need to get in place to get this thing working?
Yeah, well, with QuickBooks, where you've got the different types of expenses, I would tend to encourage the person to set up headings, which you can do as you go, for example, the various softwares that you're purchasing. So you might have a main heading called software, and, you know, whether it's lead pages or some of the other software that's available, to actually itemize it so you can keep an eye on how much you're spending on it. One of the big things that one sees is where people subscribe to something, and because they're not looking at their bank, 8 months later they go, I'm not using that. Why am I paying for it all the time? So that's the sort of thing. Whereas if you have a lump called software, that's all very well. But unless you actually look and see what's in that lump, it's not so easy to monitor what's going on.
Yeah, that does make sense. And it's absolutely true that subscriptions to software can be one of the biggest unnoticed overheads for Amazon sellers. I mean, I still, to my shame, admit I'm getting billed by A2X Accounting for linking Xero to Amazon, even though I haven't had Xero for about a year, because I'm now getting you and your team, Penny, to manage my accounts for the Amazon businesses. And we're using QuickBooks because that's what your team knows. And it's better to have a system that's integrated in your, whoever's using it knows best. So yeah, it's very easy to let these things run. So that's one thing I must, every time I get that notification, I think, I must kill that. And then a billion other things come into my inbox. So let's come back to another question, which is, what to measure. So we talked about how to measure a bit. So a spreadsheet versus online systems versus a book. And we've decided that obviously online systems and software make sense. What do we measure apart from the division between overheads and direct costs for products and gross profit margin? How else would you sort of divide the big picture up in the most meaningful way for the management accounting?
Really, if you're looking at management accounts, which is used for planning going forwards, etc., as opposed to annual accounts, which tend to historically be looking backwards, I'd be looking at the different products that you're selling, because you might find that one's lost favour or competition has dropped their prices and you'll have to drop yours. So by being able to identify the costs relating to each of your products, you can keep an eye to find out whether they're still worth continuing with.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and I think that's, yeah, that really is probably the most important use of management accounts from the point of view of something actionable for an entrepreneur. So what sort of things do we need to measure? And I've got the word need here in capital letters, because I feel like the problem with accounts often is that on the one hand, we feel instinctively that we should measure everything, or at least I do, and I'm not the only one, having talked to a lot of people about this. And then we guiltily know that we're measuring hardly anything, and the reason is because it just gets overwhelming very fast. There's a massive detail that doesn't seem to have structure. So what do we really need to measure at the most basic level, and what can we, another way of putting that is, what can we leave out?
I think if you're selling via Amazon, one of the easy to guess at figures is the number of units you're actually selling. Because if you've got a product that's seasonal, it's important to know when the season is. But generally, if you're looking to need to reorder, you need to look backwards to see how many you sell in a month, typically, to know how much longer that existing stock is going to last you going forwards. Because what you don't want to do is have a gap where your product is no longer available or can't be shipped, and then try and get the momentum up again after it's fallen short. So that's one of the big things. And again, the costs. If you paid $5 a unit for your last one, plus shipping, plus other things, how much are they going to charge you for the next one? Is it because you're buying more, they're going to charge you less? Or is it because you want the product in a hurry, they're going to charge you a lot more? So don't assume that however much you paid last time is the same as you're going to be paying for the next purchase of those items.
That's absolutely true, I have to say. And also in China, there is a nasty tendency for quite a lot of Chinese suppliers to see that once you've got a little bit committed to a product line and you've sold, you know, a few hundred, and you go back to them and you want to order 1,000 or 2,000, they have a nasty tendency, rather than necessarily putting the price down because you're ordering higher quantity, of sometimes putting the price up because they know that you can't be bothered to change suppliers because you've got to go through quality assurance of the actual products. You've got to check out the suppliers. You've got to then actually have something proven that you've done and the whole thing worked. And they know that very well. So, and yeah, I think you're absolutely right to flag that up, actually, particularly too with Chinese suppliers, and not only Chinese. I mean, sometimes the British suppliers, my experience is that one person we had selling us a product that was so profitable that actually they weren't making enough profit, probably because they went bankrupt and we couldn't buy from them. So I wouldn't even assume that you can necessarily even buy the products either. So yeah, I'd like all these things, assumption is the mother of all F-ups. That's very useful. So what are the things that beginning entrepreneurs or fairly, you know, tiny startups, solopreneur type businesses, especially with the physical product type businesses, what are the things that people tend to measure which get them kind of tied up in knots and you could actually afford to not measure in the early days?
It depends how much it fluctuates. One of the things I'm thinking of is your currency. It's something that you can't control, but you need to be aware of. So I'm looking there at what the exchange rates are. Because if you have got a period when the exchange rates are fluctuating dramatically, you might find that you buy the item in dollars, but if you're not selling it for another 6 weeks or 2 months, you don't know what the currency rate is. So, you know, keep an eye on it rather than necessarily going into the detail of six decimal places of conversion rates.
Yeah.
So that's one thought there.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think, again, if you're going to put in a $5,000 order, or, you know, technically, if you're buying it from UK dollar, UK dollars, look at me, I've been too internationalized. You're buying from pounds, as we call it, the normal people, and you're buying in China, they want US dollars. And Brexit day, for example, the days before Brexit, I was just about to put an order in. The day after Brexit, the pound dropped like a stone against the dollar, and I just stopped because that was a 15% fall, which is a very significant number, and you didn't need a microscope to measure that. And also, I was about to put a $5,000 order in, which suddenly became a $6,500 order or something, you know, and I just stopped. But yeah, that's an example of when it does make a difference. But yeah, you're quite right. I don't know the exact exchange rate right now of the products that I'm selling in Germany, for example, that we've sourced in the UK, but actually it's not fluctuating enough to make much difference. I know that 1.1 is about what I'm selling euros to pounds. So that's a very good point. And I think you also said don't go into multiple decimal places. I think a sort of foolish precision. They say, you know, what's the word? A foolish consistency is a hobgoblin of little minds. I think a foolish precision is similar for entrepreneurs, because sometimes it's like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. People know the exact exchange rate, but the fact is that the products aren't selling at all and you should gill it off. So amen to that. Last question, really, because we're going to get into another episode about more advanced things for people who are scaling up. But for those who are starting out and need to get their heads around accounting and bookkeeping, what are the one or possibly two pieces of advice that you would give to them that you think would solve them the biggest problems for them with the simplest wins from a small movement?
Right. Two examples come to mind. One is, instead of thinking about starting the business, if they were to change their car, what thoughts would they put into that? So what do they need from it? How much can they afford? How long a period are they intending keeping that car? And what ways might you finance the car? And, you know, so any questions that you'd ask for the car, in the same way you may well ask about setting up a business. So that's one. Secondly, you know, treat it as a business in that you are there to make profit. You need money in the bank before you start. Don't use credit to set it up, because you don't know how quickly the business is going to build and you can repay that credit. So I would always make sure that you've got a cushion behind you when you're looking to set up something like this.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I think particularly with a high risk, high gain sort of model, like, well, particularly on the Amazon space, but also e-commerce in general, I guess any business startup is a high risk, high gain thing potentially. And I agree that credit increases risk. I mean, I had somebody approach me a while ago for mentoring, and they said they had sort of £400 in the bank. And I said, so normally my minimum requirement for inventory capital would be around £5,000 mark. So what's going on here? And he said, oh yeah, well, the rest I'm going to borrow from my uncle. I said, okay, well, stop there. I don't think that's a great idea, because you're increasing risk greatly before, as you said, you've got any proven turnover. And also, you know, if you're borrowing from family, that can get ugly really fast if you don't pay them back as well. That can destroy a relationship, right? So I'd agree with that. And I like your car metaphor, because I love metaphors, because they are taking the familiar as a route into the unfamiliar. And they're always brilliant if they work really precisely. And I think your car metaphor is great. So thank you very much, Penny, for your, as ever, down-to-earth guidance. And, you know, you're aware of the details, but don't get buried in them, which is such a great thing in an accountant. Accountants are detail-centric people, and they have to be. But you're able to give us the big picture. So thank you very much, Penny, for your guidance for newcomers to the Amazon space and to business in general.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That's it. thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Now, over to you. First, 80-20 everything. Learn the critical few. Maybe there's one thing in this podcast that can make all the difference. Find that thing. 20% of inputs, give 80% of the outputs. Which are the critical few for you? Then take action. Imperfect action beats perfect inaction every single time. Finally, and not least, review. If you've made mistakes, learn from them. If you've made a success, duplicate it. You can't do that unless you look back. So in summary, learn the critical few, then do, then review. And then, my friend, it's up to you. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Speak to you in the next episode.